Live to see it, friends, and welcome to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-author, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. Happy Tuesday. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. We don't have a lot of Tuesday shows, do we? This is sort of a little unusual.
Once in a while, we'll do like a week where we just do a Tuesday and a Thursday, right? But on a three-show week, a Tuesday is rare. But we just Monday didn't work out this week, so here we are. You're welcome.
That's right. Right? This is our Tuesday show. We'll be back tomorrow, Wednesday, as well as Friday. So
we'll be a three-show week this week. The normal week resumes after today. Sorry we weren't here yesterday, but after that, everything kicks back into a normal Wednesday-Friday rotation. Okay, well, we got a fun show tonight, Disruptive Technologies, and I want to say some good words for our folks over there at Singularity Hub. That's a great site. You know, they all kinds of interesting stuff on that site. And this is just a really good piece by Jason Dorier. I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly, Jason. These seven disruptive technologies could be worth trillions of dollars. I start reading this article and I think, well, you know, this would just be a good whole show to do. In fact, any one of these topics is worthy of a show in its own right. But I thought Jason did a really good job of breaking down a list of some technologies that are up and coming that we're hearing a lot about that, and I like this angle, are going to be worth a load of money.
I noticed that throughout this article. It was not just interesting futuristic stuff, which is, you know, you could expect from this website, Singularity Hub, but it's also, I mean, this article would have been at home, you know, in the Wall Street Journal. Because it's definitely a, you know, here's where I think, generally speaking, where the money's going to be moving. And I found myself, as I read it, not disagreeing at all. Yeah, I found it compelling, some compelling arguments here.
Well, and I like the headline, you know, trillions of dollars these can be worth. So let's talk about some of these. Let's get into it and look at a few of these trillion-dollar potential disruptive technologies. Number one, deep learning could be worth 35 Amazons. And our friend Monica Anderson on Facebook, when I had posted this, she made note of the fact that she's been blogging recently about artificial intelligence and trying to describe in upside terms what the potential market is. And she said she read this and she realizes that she has to beef up her hype cycle significantly, and I think maybe that's true. I think if you're in AI, it's easily possible to kind of undervalue the potential here.
AI is like, the genie says you can have a wish, and you wish for unlimited wishes, right?
Yeah,
It's sort of, you say 35 Amazons. Well, yeah, 35 Amazons in 10 years maybe. But where will it be in 100 years? You know, we can't say. And because it's sort of the entry gift or the gateway to who knows what, right? So
It is. It's a gateway to harder technologies, right? To more addictive technologies. It's thinking of it as a kind of a gateway drug. I mean, they talk here about transportation, manufacturing, healthcare, finance, and more. The point is, it can underpin almost
everything.
And anything you apply it to, you can eke tremendous potential, not just financial value, but I mean, that's what we're talking about here, but not just financial value, but performance, savings, however you want to look at it. That's what it does. It has the potential to accelerate processes, to vastly simplify processes, to just deliver this really unprecedented capability to solve problems and to get things done that we've never had anything remotely like before. I guess that's what unprecedented means. I suppose I'm being redundant, but it is a quantum leap in capability that's really hard to quantify. And I even like how they came up with the estimate here. It said Bill Gates has said a breakthrough in machine learning would be worth 10 Microsofts. Microsoft is 550 to 600 billion, Wood said. We think deep learning is going to be twice that, and therefore we think it could approach 17 trillion in market cap, which would be 35 Amazons. So either way, we're talking.
Here's the thing, though. I mean, Amazon is going to grow more valuable because of deep learning. So who's to say, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, 13. Yeah, that's right. It's 35
Amazons
today's
today.
Amazons.
Yeah, today's Amazons. But you know, by the time this happens, Amazon's will continue to grow as well. So yeah, like you say, it's you know, a gateway technology to so many other things that. Well, you think about it this way, Phil. When we were kids, I mean, when we thought of technology jobs back in the 70s, let's say, you know, we wouldn't think of things like an auto mechanic, right? Or we wouldn't think of home builders, things like that. But hey, those are technology jobs today, you know. And so when we think of deep learning, right now we're thinking of huge businesses like Amazon, right, and that use deep learning to better service or whatever, or better make money.
Yeah,
for their
Google,
company, right?
Amazon,
yeah,
Microsoft,
big companies.
Right?
But hey,
Facebook.
It's that stuff filters down to everything at some point, and it's hard to imagine an area it won't touch.
Other thing that got my attention about this one is just that $17 trillion figure. Isn't that about what the national debt is?
Yeah, I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 20. Trillion, yeah, I think.
Oh, is
right.
It 20 trillion? At one point, not too long ago, it was 17 trillion. That's a number you recognize it when you see it more than once, right? It's like, oh, 17 trillion, where have I seen that number before? The fact that there's that much value to be had in something is encouraging. It's like, well, okay, between deep learning and maybe a few other technologies, we can get ourselves out of debt. Who knows? We can raise that kind of...
19.8 trillion as of November of last year.
Okay, well, I am now going to peg deep learning's value to the national debt. Okay,
okay, so there you go.
Whatever the national debt goes to, deep learning is worth at least that much. So I'm going to say 17
well,
trillion
and,
is too
you
low.
Know, and the national debt sort of has this exponential thing going on. Maybe the exponential value of something like deep learning can help us deal with the exponential problem of the debt.
There you go. I think everybody's underestimating it. That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. Imagine how much debt we can get into. That's how much it's worth. Okay.
don't tell the politicians they will.
Yeah, please don't. Yes. Okay, number two, fleets of autonomous taxis to overtake automakers. This is a really interesting idea.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of basically self-driving cars replacing owned cars, right? Isn't that kind of where we're going with this?
That's right. Sort of a, just-in-time method of, you know, you pull out your phone, you need to go someplace, pull out your phone, a car shows up, and there you go.
Right.
It's interesting, the car's not even being driven by anybody. It just shows up, you know, and then you hop in, and it takes you where you want to go. And then, you know, that's not your car. What you own is the right to be transported, not a
right.
car.
Right.
You know, so... And that's to me, that's pretty cool because, you know, our homes, for example, they're built around the car as much as they are us for the most
that's
part.
That's right.
You know, you have this big, ugly garage door in front of most of our homes.
Hanging out the front of your house. Yeah, this driveway thing. Taking up all your front yard. Yep.
That's right. You could beautify your home and not even have to deal with that. The car drops you off at your house and... You know, you walk in. It's made for you, not for a car. And there's so many things that will change if this were to become the model. But you know what? Looking at this as an automaker, you know, why isn't General Motors buying Uber? Or you know, it may be too late. They may already be too expensive.
Well, I don't know. Uber potentially could be available for a discount here pretty soon. I'm thinking at the
well,
right
maybe
thing.
So, maybe so, but. One of the companies, if they're smart, they're going to either buy an Uber or have a division within their company that becomes their internal Uber or something. I don't know.
Well, and if they're smart, right? In the story, they talk about Tesla potentially doing this, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
going with your if they're smart philosophy, Tesla understands maybe better than a traditional automaker does what space they're in.
Right.
The car makers are going to have a hard time picturing themselves as deriving a primary value proposition out of anything other than the manufacture and sale of automobiles. That is a hard paradigm for them to escape from. Tesla,
and,
maybe not.
And that, isn't that always the case, though? I mean, you know, the big guys are end up perishing when the new paradigm comes around because they can't make the shift. You know, Kodak couldn't make the shift. They didn't. You know, they felt that they were in the film business. They're not in the. They weren't in the film business. They were in the picture business. You know, and if they'd realized that they maybe could have made the digital jump sooner than they did, and they could have survived. But anyway,
doing smartphones now. Did you know Kodak now sells phones with really good cameras on them, and they've done okay for themselves out there in the world. But that's an odd little potential partial comeback for a company that otherwise should just own that space, right?
Yeah.
I mean, who ends up owning it is Apple, what they probably would have thought of as a computer company by way of their phones, which doesn't even make any sense. It's like, how did they take over the camera business? Oh, they started selling phones. What? Well, it makes total sense to us now.
Yeah, you
but there was a time when that wouldn't have sounded like it made any sense at all.
Yeah,
right?
I understand the English words that you're saying, but you string them together like that, and that doesn't, you know.
It doesn't make any sense. And I think,
right.
You know, that's the problem. You go into GM and you sit down and you go, okay, here's the future. We're not in the car manufacturing business. We're in the self-driving taxi business, right? They're just like, you know,
what?
They just scratch their heads. It's like, we sort of can imagine self-driving taxis, but those will be cars we sell to somebody who runs a self-driving taxi. They can't get themselves onto the right side of the transaction, because it's
too big a leap.
It's too ephemeral. It's too big of a leap for them to make.
They could get killed by their stockholders too if they push too hard too fast into that. So it really is a balancing act, and I'm not suggesting that the guys that are running those companies are dumb. They're not. They're brilliant, but often they're brilliant they're so brilliant with the old paradigm that they can't make the jump. Sometimes, and it's the new guys that come along and take over their space. So,
anyway, they're
good luck. Good luck to all of them. I hope they make it. But
they're saying this is gonna push to about a $10 trillion market in the early 2030s. So, roughly about half of that deep learning market, but still, that's some pretty good bucks. You know,
yeah.
I wouldn't.
And deep learning is behind this too, right? So,
absolutely.
Again, a gateway.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll probably be able to say that about all of these.
Every single one of the stories we mentioned tonight, including the next one, 3D printing goes big with finished products at scale. So what are we talking about here?
Well, you know, what we're talking about is something beyond the kind of simple 3D printing models that we've thought about before. You know, we think about 3D printer as kind of a novelty, as a technology that brings this crude fabrication capability to the desktop, so that people in schools or people at home can you know, produce some
well,
of the items.
These machines were originally called rapid prototypers, right? So that they would make these small prototypes. You know, if you're a big car company, let's say, and you wanted, well, what is this car going to look like? You know, somebody with a 3D printer on their desk would give you a rapid prototype that would be like the size of a toy car, right?
Right.
And they could pass it around the boardroom and say, yeah, this is what the car is going to look like. But they're saying that they're going big with finished products that are, you know, indistinguishable from what you would buy, off the shelf, right? So
exactly. Yeah. And what they talk about in this story is the fact that where it's been used for prototyping up to now, now we're talking about actually taking the 3D printer and putting it into production, into the production cycle. The example they give here is Adidas mass producing, they say, shoe midsoles, which I assume is the core part of the core part of the shoe, but not through a traditional manufacturing assembly line, but through 3D printing, which is one of the things interesting about that is if you do that at scale, anytime you want to make the slightest tweak to that shoe, or a big tweak to the shoe, right, or make any change you want to the shoe, it's just as simple as writing the code, right, and you're ready to make the change. So this is definitely industrial scale 3D printing that we're talking about here, not the near and dear to our hearts 3D printing that we talk about, which is having it in our home and being able to make the shoes there, which is great with the you know the idea of the universal 3D printer. But here in this setting, they're talking about a $41 billion market within the next 2.5 years, right? They're saying by 2020, and as much as a $490 billion market by 2025. So essentially, we're going to see this shift within production, within manufacturing production, to 3D printing. It's going to become the way that things get made, basically.
Well, you know, this is part of the coffee shopification of everything article,
right.
The idea that I had, but, you know, ultimately, you know, you can go to your coffee shop and order whatever products you need, and they're printed for you right there in your coffee shop, right? Everything becomes a coffee shop at that point. This is part of the picture. Now, you know, do I think that there, you know, that it all happens necessarily in your local coffee shop? No, I think that we move towards that, where, you know, instead of having regional factories or maybe even a national factory like we do today to produce something, or overseas factories or whatever, it's produced much closer to us, and it gets closer and closer to us all along, where and by doing so, you know, you cut out a lot of your transportation costs. You can stock less. You know, you can, and there's a lot of cost associated with stocking goods on a shelf.
Sure.
And if you're able to produce things more on a just-in-time basis, then that's more profitable for the manufacturers, and probably will end up being cheaper for the consumer. So this is a big deal.
What I liken 3D printing to, it's kind of like artificial intelligence. When the idea is first introduced, everyone sees the term as being synonymous with AGI, artificial general intelligence,
right,
with the idea of a computer that thinks like a human being. And then suddenly progress is made in AI with narrow AI. It's not AGI, but it's AI used to solve very, very specific, very distinct problems. And that's really where AI was all through the 90s and the aughts, and even early into the decade that we're in now. Machine learning and some of these other technologies come along, and we're suddenly closing back in on AGI, so then we're closing back in to this general purpose artificial intelligence. But I think that's, you can kind of see a similar trend with 3D printing. We hear about 3D printing, and the promise of 3D printing is these general printers that can make anything for anybody. And great, but it turns out it may be that the first big breakthrough money-making applications for 3D printing will be more narrow applications, right? Like a business that wants to make its own shoes but use a 3D printer rather than use the traditional manufacturing process. So suddenly we'll have, you know, this big growth in narrow 3D printing, leading eventually to probably breakthroughs in technology, no doubt driven by deep learning, that will that will move us more towards the kind of general printers that we like talking about and thinking about. But along the way, it's going to be worth some significant money and another big growth area. Okay, we got to move on. We're going to run out of time before we run out of topics. CRISPR starts with genetic therapy, but it doesn't end there. And they start out just talking about the cost of genome editing, how it's fallen from 28x to 52x in the last 4 years. Okay, so the cost of genome editing is plummeting. And CRISPR is kind of leading the editing revolution, as they describe it here, you know, cutting the time and the cost, keeping the whole process efficient. But we've probably only scratched the surface, not even beginning to scratch the surface, in terms of the business upside here. And the one they talk about is one we talked about on a recent show, which is just looking at these single gene diseases.
Yeah.
They say that only about 5% are treatable today, and just addressing those through this newly simplified genome editing, they describe it as a $70 billion market. You know, it's interesting, that other article we looked at when we talked about this topic, the economic upside of going into that space, I don't think was ever mentioned, right? I don't think anybody ever did the calculation and said it's worth $70 billion. But you know what? That's a number that gets somebody's attention, and they'll go, okay, well, we got to get into this. We want
Well, the company that has made CRISPR. When I was reading this article, I said, let me check on this. Well, who owns CRISPR, the technology? It's a company called Origin Technologies. And it's interesting, Origin Technologies is not publicly traded, but it looks like a Chinese company, Zhuangjin Union Stem Cell Bioengineering, is publicly traded, and looks like they're trying to buy them. And so that's interesting. It may not be a household name, but the people who know this space are very interested in this and are watching this very closely. It's a huge deal.
Reason is because you can look past the single gene diseases, and they missed stem cell therapy research, personalized medicine, drug development, agricultural biofuels.
Just biofuels. Imagine if you're able to, have a factory that you're feeding, sunlight and minerals to, and it produces oil for you.
Right.
I mean, and practically unlimited quantities. And hey, and because it's uptaking. Because the biological organism that's giving you the oil is uptaking CO2 as part of the process, then it's more ecologically it's better for the planet than pumping it out of the ground, right?
So absolutely, yeah.
So that's huge about just that one area.
That one could potentially dwarf the $70 billion for the single gene diseases, as could agriculture or some of these others is too. So as appealing as the $70 billion sounds, that might be on the low end of the applications for this kind of gene editing based technology. Huge upsides there, and I don't know. Stay tuned. We'll hear more about it soon.
And I'm going to say biofuels is better. Is politically is so much better for the world than having having countries that instead of putting money into the their people, just pull it out of the ground and sell it. It's just I could get into that. I'm sorry, I probably shouldn't have. But anyway, next one's mobile transactions could grow 15 times by 2020. So.
How about this? Okay, by 2020, 75% of the world will own a smartphone. I don't know. I wonder what the percentage is right now. Pretty interesting.
I would imagine it's in excess of 50%, I would guess. But we're talking about the whole world here, though.
So yeah, mobile transactions currently account for about $1 trillion today. He expects the person making the prediction here expects them to grow 15 times, upwards of $15 trillion. Within the next couple of years, okay. So this is a huge, huge leap that we're looking to see over the next couple of years. Talk about the fact that Asia is really a leading player here.
Places like Africa, for example. I mean, places that may never have had wired phones into people's homes are going cellular faster than we as the United States did, and so. They're leapfrogging in that way, but they're also leapfrogging in attitudes among the population. I think there's going to be greater acceptance of mobile transactions in places that were, formerly undeveloped.
If you don't have a phone network, what are the chances you have a bank anyway, right?
Right. You use mobile transactions instead.
That's right. You can send some money from this phone to that phone. Somebody needs to pay for something, they can send money from their phone to your phone. I mean, suddenly it's, it is so much more than that ability to talk over a wire. I mean, that's part of what has driven the huge uptake of this technology in places like Africa and other parts of the developing world where they didn't have the infrastructure before, is because it's not just voice service, that they're getting. They're getting so much more. They're getting connected to the internet. They're getting cameras, right? They're able to share media. They're able to be on social media, and they're able to do things like engage in transactions, which were all really hard to do before. And suddenly, it's like this whole world opens up. And yeah, you can see where that's going to be huge. I think it's very interesting that Asia is the big player in mobile transactions, and the two companies they named, Tencent and Alipay, and of course Alipay has got to be connected to Alibaba, right? So a big Chinese outfit there. Interesting to think that we might, you know, in the West, we might be being left behind here in the mobile transaction space, that space is maybe being defined in other parts of the world for us right now.
Well, I mean, and, you know, other, you know, just as kind of an example, you know, things like smart credit cards, it took forever for us to adapt that in the United States. And, you know, they've been in places like Europe for a couple of decades. I don't know. You get used to the last paradigm, and you're often the slowest to pick up the next development. For whatever
we like things when we get used to them around here.
Yeah, sure.
We get used to things and we like them. Okay, yeah. How about number six? Robotics and automation to liberate $12 trillion by 2035. What's that mean, liberate? That sounds like that's kind of a Robin Hood feel to it, doesn't it?
No, that's right. You know, that's the guy that that held up the bank here locally. He was liberating some money, wasn't he? Well, it's interesting the example they give here that Amazon's robot workforce in warehouses has grown from 1,000 to nearly 50,000 robots since 2014. So in three short years, a 50-fold increase in three years. And they said they've never laid off anyone other than for performance reasons in their distribution centers. Here's my thought. They may have not laid anybody off in their distribution centers. They were laying people off in the local Walmarts and Sears is where
they
were laying.
they were.
That's what is happening there. But you can't blame Amazon for being efficient and being the next gen.
Here's what they say. These robots are going to give us a $40 trillion economy, where we would have had a $28 trillion economy without them. Okay, so now we're really closing in on the technologies that might cure the national debt, right? I mean, when you add $12 trillion to the GDP bottom line, that's significant, right?
Yeah.
And even with all of the problems and all of the heartache, and we've got to figure this stuff out, stuff going on around employment, if we can grow our economy by $12 trillion, I say we do it, huh? I mean, who's with me? That's probably probably a good idea.
Everybody that has a vested interest in the stock market growing is with you on that.
Exactly. I mean, I think we can all agree that, given a choice, it's better if we have $40 trillion than $28 trillion. It just sounds better to me. I didn't take a lot of math in college, but it just, for me, that kind of works. And I think that that number, if they're not just pulling it out of the air, and I get the impression that they're not, that says a lot. It says an awful lot about how sweeping the changes that robotics is going to make, how sweeping those changes are going to be. And again, probably a lot of them driven by deep learning type stuff. So it all kind of falls
back
to that one.
And I think there are some ways that robots are going to be, to some extent, invisible to us. Now, I mean, there'll be obvious robots at some point. You know, we'll live in the world where there's robots walking around at some point on the streets along with the rest of us. You know, we'll see the Will Smith future at some point, right?
Yep.
But I think that there's going to be a lot of robots behind the scenes before we see them. You know, and what am I talking about? Things like an Amazon storefront where you walk in and it looks like a small store, but practically anything you need from Amazon, it can get to you real quick. And so what's happening is, like, you know, not only does it own this small storefront on the street, but it also owns the 10 stories above you, right? And there's robots going back and forth, shuffling things into chutes to shoot it down to the first floor because you wanted it,
right?
And you never see these robots. All of a sudden you get what you need, you know, as soon as you tell a clerk or whatever.
Right, but they're back there. They're back there making things happen all the time and driving that kind of value. Absolutely. Huge stuff. Okay, number seven, blockchain and crypto assets, speculatively spectacular. I read this. I had to reread this line, and I think this is correct. I've heard recently that Bitcoin has a market value of nearly $40 billion, but I didn't realize it's up from just $3 billion 2 years ago. So I can sort of understand those who think that maybe Bitcoin is a bubble, if anything undergoing that kind of growth. But they talk here about the rapid adoption of crypto assets, the rapid adoption of blockchain transactions. And I would actually swing this one back to the one before last about the mobile transactions. It seems to me that this is kind of a piece with that individuals all around the world are looking for secure ways to move money around, secure ways to have assets. They don't necessarily want to have them under the purview of their local or national government. And here's this emerging kind of alternative. How big is it going to be? Well, their guesses are all over the map. 1 to 5 trillion, 5 to 10 trillion, 10 plus trillion in 10 years. Who knows? If Bitcoin continues to grow at the rate that it has over the last couple of years, then it's no problem at all to get to 10 trillion. I think there's still probably quite a few growing pains before the blockchain currencies actually get that big, but I don't know. I think we're going to see huge stuff with these.
Yeah, I don't have much to contribute on this one, Phil. I, quite frankly, this one is sort of flown under my radar. I have not followed crypto assets and all that closely, and that's a shame because, like you say, in 2 years it's grown massively. So. I need to follow a little closer.
Well, it's almost like we should make a bookmark here and say, let's see where Bitcoin is in 2 years. You know,
yeah.
Is it at 80 billion? Is it at 150 billion? Is it back down to 3? Right. A lot will depend on what happens over the next 6 months, the next year and a half or so. But if it continues at the rate it's going, yeah, we're going to see a huge disruption there. And in fact, all these technologies are completely disruptive. Okay, we're out of time, Stephen, but pick one. Pick one of these technologies. Which one's the big one, do you think?
Oh, definitely the first one. I'd have to go with deep learning. What about you?
It's that or the automation, but those are pretty closely tied. So I'm going to say, since you took deep learning, I'll take automation.
Okay.
And let the chips fall. All right. Well, hey, great talking with you, Stephen. Great being with you all. We're going to be back again on Wednesday with a brand new show. It will be amazing. Look forward to being with you all then. And until next time, live to see it.